From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early 1970s. Roughly half of American households had at least one gun. That's according to the General Social Survey, conducted every 2 years, that asks a sample of American adults if they have guns at home. Fast forward 45 years, the number of American homes with at least one gun is roughly 30%, but gun sales are up. And so, as you might guess, while fewer people have guns, the people who do own guns tend to own more of them. And why are people buying more? The Washington Post reported on the so-called Obama effect, in which gun owners fear the government taking their guns, so they stock up every time the president talks about new legislation. Steve Clark owns Clark Brothers Guns and Ammo in Virginia. He told the Washington Post, quote, "I want people to buy guns because they enjoy them or need them for personal protection, not because they fear that the government will try to ban them. But everything in the store is selling. Obama set it off again," end quote. This Thursday, a public forum will focus on how we might define, quote, sensible gun laws. It's sponsored by the Rochester Coalition for Reasonable Gun Laws. And now you might be wondering, who decides what's reasonable? Who decides what's sensible? Well, you can help us have that conversation as we talk about that this hour. The Coalition's guest on Thursday night is Dr. Robert Spitzer, a distinguished service professor of political science at SUNY Cortland and an author who has written on this subject for quite a long time. But first, he's on the line with us, one of my guests for the hour on Connections. Dr. Spitzer, thanks for taking the time to come on the program, sir.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. I hope you can hear
us. Okay, I can't really hear you.
Oh.
Not very well.
Well, we'll work on that, and hopefully we will fix that. Also here, let me welcome our guest in the studio. Neil Jasek's here. He is with the Rochester Coalition for Reasonable Gun Laws. And Neil, can you just define what that coalition is and if there is a goal that the coalition has? And get right on the top of that microphone, Neil.
Yeah, well, the coalition is relatively new and in the process of forming. We got started probably about 3 or 4 months ago with a program at the Little Theater showing a documentary on the state of gun laws in the United States. We had another program about 3 weeks ago where David Tennant, one of our local lawyers who was with the Bar Association's Committee on the Second Amendment, gave a presentation on exactly what the Second Amendment is and what one can do in this country, both as a result of it. And then the third piece is going to be on Thursday night to address the question of exactly you're raising. What are reasonable gun laws? What can they accomplish? And are they worth it?
All right. Also in studio with us is Dave Jenkins, the founder of Rochester Personal Defense LLC. Dave, nice to have you back here.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be back.
And Chris Nakis is here. He's a gun owner. And the last time we talked, we were talking hunting today, talking gun ownership. Chris, welcome to you as well.
All right. Thank you.
And I want to make sure we've got a good connection with Dr. Spitzer. Dr. Spitzer, how are you doing there? Can you hear us?
I can just barely hear you, but I'm hearing discussions with your technical people.
Ah.
So I hope you can hear me, but I can barely hear you all.
Okay. Well, Dr. Spitzer.
I think somebody threw a switch that seemed to somehow change the quality of what I'm getting.
Okay. Well, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to re-rack that connection and get it established. And as we do that, let me ask Neil Jasek why you wanted to bring in Dr. Spitzer to begin with for this program on Thursday night. Neil?
Well, actually, it's a personal thing of mine. There, right after the Oregon,
the Umpqua Community College, yeah.
Yeah. Personally, this is not my main subject. I'm more interested in a lot of other things, but I just felt that how many times do we have to deal with this, and wouldn't it be nice if at least we should get to talking about facts. What are reasonable gun laws? Do they work? Is it worth going after them? Can they actually accomplish some good? Because I do agree with the basic premise of the Second Amendment that people have a right to own guns. But as the courts have said, there's also within its purview to put reasonable restrictions on that. And so let's see what we can do to deal with what is indeed a horrible statistic in this country in terms of the number of people that are killed each year as a result of a gunfire.
People like Chris Nakis don't seem to trust that organizations like this respect the Second Amendment, wouldn't abolish it, wouldn't have it repealed. Do you have a suspicion that this is about confiscation?
It always is.
Yeah,
there are always laws. We have abundance of laws anyways, that each state has its own laws. Actually, each city has its own laws concerning whom can purchase a gun, who cannot. You have to go through certain application processes. And there are plenty of laws out there. I'd like to hear what they have to say about other sensible requirements you have to have in order to own a gun.
You do seem annoyed by the idea that there are a lot of laws around guns.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Obviously, what happened? We had our beautiful Governor Cuomo. He set up a law that you can't have a rifle with a pistol grip. But then they just change it around, and now you can just have a rifle with a thumb hole that acts as a pistol grip. The manufacturers are going to change it around, and a rifle with a pistol grip does not. I mean, it's just a cosmetic aspect to a rifle. If you take away that rifle, it's not going to stop anybody else from shooting anybody with a shotgun, with anything else. It's just ridiculous. These laws are redundant and ridiculous.
All right, what Chris is talking about when it comes to the SAFE Act is some of the conversations we've had on this program have kind of laid out how gun owners can kind of circumvent the way the laws are, modifying a piece of plastic on a so-called assault rifle, that kind of a thing. In other words,
not an assault rifle.
No, that's what I understand.
Not an assault, but we'll use the correct terminology. An assault rifle is an automatic weapon. It's a semi-automatic gun.
I understand what it is. That's why I called it a so-called assault rifle. Some people use the term. I understand. Listen, the point being, we've laid out how in some ways, these laws are easily circumvented and looked to be ineffectual on certain levels. And that's what Chris is talking about, you know, saying, why are we passing these laws? They're easy to circumvent, and they are meant to create barriers for gun owners to owning firearms. So, but Chris, back to the point at hand, though, do you think that the ultimate goal is for these organizations not to do what Neil says, which is respect the Second Amendment, but put restrictions on them, but to take away all guns? Is that the concern?
Yes, actually it is, because it is a slippery slope, if you want to use the cliche, and it's been done, obviously, in England. England passed a law in 1689, whatever it is, I can't remember the whole thing, but they had a right, their citizenry had a right to possess firearms back then. Over time, by 1970, I believe, in the 70s, now there aren't the citizenship cannot own a firearm, whether a pistol, and I'm not sure about long rifles. You probably have to go through some type of process in order to obtain a hunting rifle there. That's probably restrictive and has a lot of regulations to it. But sure, they lost their right to possess arm, and I'm pretty sure that is always the goal of these little organizations, just to chip away. And because these laws, like certain clips, you can't have more than 10 rounds in a clip, it really doesn't do anything to stop a murder.
Okay.
Whether it's in Sandy Hook, whether it's in Oregon, whether it's in San Bernardino, those laws do not apply to anything, because it's just not anything that would have prevented those types of crimes.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to ask our guests in studio for some definitions here, and then we're going to try to bring Dr. Spitzer back in, because I think we've reestablished a connection. But Chris, let me ask you,
mm-hmm.
Neil, Dave, I want to ask you the same question then. Chris, your concern is that this is all a Trojan horse for full confiscation.
Absolutely. I'm
okay.
Greek, so I can smell that a mile away.
Okay. Then what would be a reasonable gun law? Should there be gun laws at all?
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
Then where do we draw the line? Where should that be?
I think, for instance, in New York State right now, it's overboard of what was just passed with the SAFE Act. There should be a background check to see whether you're a felon. There's a good reasonable thing. I don't know.
Okay, so
we can go back and forth if
okay.
You want to give me some examples, and I can tell you whether I think that's reasonable or not.
Okay, so you're not against all gun laws, but you're concerned that all of the current proposals are actually about confiscation.
Absolutely, because it begins this way. Look, in the 90s when they started to take away the so-called assault rifle, which they misdefined, and which it isn't. There's just semi-automatic rifles that we should be able to possess with magazines, however big we want to have our magazines.
Okay, I don't want to sort of derail the conversation, but a question that comes up a lot for people who don't own guns, and I think it's a good faith question, Chris, is what do you need a semi-automatic for? What do you use it for?
Well, it's not what somebody thinks that I need. It's what I would, well, first of all, I have a semi-automatic pistol. I have one pistol, which
generally
is a 45.
Yeah, right.
But it doesn't matter. It's not up to little groups and little councils to say what the citizenry needs, what people need, is what each individual needs, what
but
individual
of course
wants.
It is.
Yeah, if you want,
if a shoulder-fired missile is out of bounds to you, then we are drawing the line somewhere. And
okay.
What we're trying to understand is where.
All
it's
right.
Going.
Okay. So, a perfectly understanding. I'm perfectly willing to say the citizens should not have a fully automatic rifle. All right?
Sure.
Now, a semi-automatic rifle, they're all out there, whether it's a shotgun, whether it is an AR-15, whether it's an AK-47 brought down so it's not an automatic rifle. Yes, people should be able to have those.
But you're saying you'll draw the line at fully automatic, but you're kind of mocking the idea that people would be concerned about semi-automatic.
Absolutely. What is a semi-automatic rifle? What is a shotgun? A Remington shotgun is a semi-automatic. All you're doing, you're pulling the trigger one time, one round is going out, and you pull it again, another round comes out.
So why take fully automatic out of the hands of the citizenry then?
Well, fully automatic rifles, in my opinion, if you want my real opinion,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, my real opinion is no, because we are citizens of the United States, we should be able to own a rifle that the military owns because we are a militia, and I would say no. We should have a automatic rifle, but what was it, 1920s, 1930s, over the prohibition, and obviously the government set up laws in order for people not to have liquor. So
yeah.
Then there was a black market that they created, which was obviously brought in by, dirty guys, and they were using automatic rifles, and you had gun wars, and obviously they took away the automatic rifle at that point. So was it the government again? Yeah, absolutely. And can I live with that? I've lived with it. Now do you start taking away semi-automatic rifles? Then what do you start taking away from the
All right,
the
so
citizens?
That's where you see it as a slippery slope. Okay, so in other words, for Chris Nakis, the reasonable gun laws are not the current proposals. It's something much more scaled back. Background checks should be in play. Felons should not be owning guns. Fully automatic should be where a line is drawn. Dave Jenkins is the founder of Rochester Personal Defense, LLC. Reasonable to you means what, Dave?
Reasonable to me means if somebody is a good person, I'll back up a little bit to that, who should own a gun? Obviously, somebody who's a criminal who would mean other people harm, no, should not have a gun. If you're a dangerous person or you're, we do have, realistically, what we're really talking about is it's a people issue, not really a gun issue. But the guns happen to be the tool of trade for some of the people that want to do people harm. So what we're looking at is what are some reasonable restrictions? Obviously, if you're granted to be a good person, whether it's by a background check or an interview with a law enforcement officer, akin to what we go through to get a permit in New York State, then you should be able to own a firearm without restriction as long as you remain a good person.
A good person, Stan? I've never heard this before. I don't want the government deciding what's a good person and a bad person, do you?
Somebody has to, unfortunately. Who's it going to be, though?
No, they decide who's a felon and who's not a felon,
yeah.
But
well,
a good person,
that's more
person.
Of what I mean.
Well, I don't think he's making a moral
It's more of what I mean.
Yeah, okay.
You're not a felon. You're not a victimizer. You're not a predatory criminal.
Okay.
And you've passed that test. What more should you need to do? Because the one thing that we see all the time, although my end is more training than political, it does blend a lot. And what happens is the limitations make it harder for the law-abiding gun owner, the good person, to continue to be law-abiding. New York State, by its definition of laws compared to other surrounding states, makes felons just because they step one foot inside the state, even though they're legal in Pennsylvania or Vermont or another state. They come to New York. Our laws say they're now a felon. But they didn't do anything wrong.
Okay. Neil Jastic, you heard Chris and Dave, particularly Chris's concerns about looking at history, looking at Great Britain, looking at our own gun laws, feeling like from here on out it's a slippery slope to confiscation.
Well, I'll be brief because I want to get to Dr.
Absolutely.
Spitzer. But, what can I say? How many times do I have to say no? We are not interested in confiscating guns. As a kid, I shot rifles for sport. I was a target shooter. I went all the way to expert marksman under the junior NRA program. I was in the service. I used rifles there. I'm not against guns, but I am exactly what I think Dave was talking about, is ensuring that guns are in the hand of people who are unlikely to use them for malicious, harmful purposes, and that the degree of weaponry that's out in the community is such that it's unlikely to be used that we can limit the extent and damage that can be done by that kind of a weapon if indeed it were to be used maliciously.
All right. Dr. Robert Spitzer, a distinguished service professor of political science at SUNY Cortland, will be here on Thursday night. That's May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Third Presbyterian Church on East Avenue. Neil's organization. It's not Neil's organization.
It's not mine.
You don't want to claim ownership over all of it. It's the Rochester Coalition for Reasonable Gun Laws. That's a coalition of three Rochester area organizations.
Actually, we're about six now.
Okay. Thank you. See? Look, you're growing as we speak here. 7 p.m. Thursday night, and Dr. Spitzer will be here. Dr. Spitzer, thanks for hanging in there with some of the technical difficulties. I don't know how much you've been able to hear, but if you want to weigh in on what you've been hearing, and then we'll kind of take it from here on what you're going to be talking about Thursday night. Go ahead, sir.
Well, sure. I hope you can hear me okay.
We can, yes.
Let me begin by making a couple of points. On the issue of confiscation, there are two things that weigh against that. The first is American history. Well, three things. The first is American history. The second is contemporary American gun practices. And the third is the Supreme Court. In 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that Americans have a constitutional right to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. And so that established as a constitutional right to gun ownership. Now, the court also said in that decision that it's reasonable to impose limitations on that right. And that could include, for example, the ownership of exotic or unusual weapons, like, say, a fully automatic weapon, a so-called machine gun. So confiscation is something people talk about, but it's nothing but rhetorical puffery, essentially. It's not something that has anything to do with modern American gun practices. Secondly, there's an important historical point to make about gun laws, because we think that in that sort of the gun laws we know about and have been talking about, you know, as a society for a number of years, is a fairly new phenomenon that, beginning in the 1930s, the federal government began to enact some stronger gun laws, or some gun laws, I should say, which indeed it did, and there haven't been many, but there have been some. But there's been quite a bit of research in the last few years that demonstrates that actually gun laws not only existed early as America began, and literally with the Jamestown colony in 1619, but that the colonies and then the states enacted literally thousands of gun laws of every imaginable variety, to such an extent that in many respects guns were more strictly regulated in the country's first 300 years than in the last 30 or 40 years. And this is something I'll be talking about a little bit come Thursday night. So the idea of gun regulation is actually an old idea. It's not a new idea. And I would make the further argument that in most of our history, gun laws and gun rights really went together. There was no profound clash between the two. In modern politics, of course, there is. Everything, you know, we think now of the gun issue as this kind of death struggle between the protection of gun rights on the one hand versus extending gun laws on the other hand. But and while, you know, people certainly line up in those two camps, that's really not American history at all. And on the question of semi-automatic weapons, which, of course, when Congress passed a limited ban on semi-automatic weapons in 1994, a law that was in place at the federal level for 10 years, it listed 19 types of assault weapons that were barred along with some copycat models. but also listed about 670 other types of semi-automatic weapons that were legal to own. And, you know, much debate about that law. The law did lapse. New York State has a pretty strict assault weapons type restriction in place. But one of the facts that's been revealed from historical research on gun laws is that in the 1920s and early 30s, between 7 and 10 states enacted their own restrictions and in two cases barred entirely semi-automatic weapons. Now, those laws are not in place today, of course, but they were enacted way back in the 1920s. I mean, who would have guessed, right? So the idea that gun laws are, you know, a new encroachment on freedom isn't really a part of our history at all.
Let me also let our listeners know, I know there's a couple of folks waiting to join the conversation, and we're going to get to your phone calls coming up here, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, if you want to join the conversation. A listener named Jim sent an email this morning, and he wanted to clarify a couple of points. Essentially, what he wanted to know is, you know, again, trying to define who means what by sensible or reasonable. And Dr. Spitzer, Jim wrote to us, quote, "I grew up in New Jersey with the most draconian state gun laws in America. New Jersey requires a police-issued permit for a Daisy BB gun because any gun that propels anything, including air guns, is considered a firearm. Residents have been arrested and jailed for having a toy airsoft pistol that shoots harmless plastic balls without a concealed pistol permit, which is impossible to get because New Jersey is the last state that denies them to ordinary citizens, only retired police and other well-connected public officials. Likewise, you can look up the gun laws of New York City, where I lived for 14 years, Jim says. The gun laws of New York City and New Jersey and the majority anti-gun culture of the New York metropolitan area are what gun control advocates consider, quote, sensible common sense. Gun owners and non-gun owners who understand guns consider them asinine and draconian. And Jim wants to know, Dr. Spitzer, where do you come down on New Jersey and New York City? Is that sensible or is that too much?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about New Jersey state law. I'd be a little surprised. They certainly have fairly strict laws. And if the people of the state of New Jersey believe that the laws they have are appropriate for their, you know, for their environment, then that's up to them. It is certainly true that New York City has strict laws, and indeed New York City gun laws are stricter than those of the state as a whole. And that actually is not a unique thing pertaining to guns, because New York City has other laws and regulations that are sometimes different from the 57 counties that compose upstate New York and Long Island versus the five boroughs of New York. And New York is a huge city of 8 million people, people living on top of each other, and the government of the city of New York has made a series of decisions that in the context of living in that large city, that it's a good idea to have laws that are pretty strict in terms of who can get a gun and under what circumstances. So, you know, here again, I'm not questioning the public policy of New York City, but it's not too hard to figure out why the laws of the city are stricter than those, for example, here in upstate. So if you want a pistol permit in New York City, it's quite tough and more expensive than it is here in upstate New York, and that's something I actually know something about.
And that's something that you think makes logical sense and should be the case? In other words, in metropolitan areas, in urban settings, in densely populated areas, it should be more expensive and more difficult to get guns, yes or no?
Well, I would say that if you look at cities versus rural areas, that gun ownership generally is lowest in cities. There's less interest in guns among people who live in cities. And cities generally have a crime problem with respect to guns. So I think if you were to draw a dividing line, it makes more sense to draw it between big cities and the rest of a less populated area than you would between the states.
Dave Jenkins, who's the founder of Rochester Personal Defense LLC, do you have, from a personal defense concern, the idea that we can see, gun violence in urban settings, does that make you concerned or have any questions about if we are more restrictive on gun laws, does that, do you think, make the population less safe?
Actually, the facts point to themselves. You look at cities that have very, very restrictive gun laws, or they completely eliminate the ability for their residents to own firearms for self-defense, and the crime rates are out of sight. There are some cities that they're in some parts of some cities, such as Detroit, where the police They don't even go anymore.
People often point to Chicago, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
Dr. Spitz can weigh on that in a moment, but is that what you're talking about, Dave?
Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Baltimore City. They are among states and cities that have very, very strict gun control. I'll give you an example. Back in 1982 in Kennesaw, Georgia, for a while there were like the leader in civic responsibility for firearms. They passed a law requiring the heads of household to keep at least one firearm in the house and be responsible and familiar in the use of it. They just didn't say go out and buy a gun and have it in the house. They said we want you to have one but also be trained in it. So for safety, safe storage, as well as the use of it if needed. And subsequently, the crime rate in Kennesaw, Georgia dropped 89%. And Kennesaw, Georgia, well, 89% compared to a 10.4 drop in Georgia's overall crime rate. So they were well ahead of the drop in crime rate. And right now they still are about 85% lower than Georgia's or the national average in crime.
All right, so Dr. Spitzer, that story, and then you look at the Chicagos of the world, does that lend any support to Dave's concern that when you are overly restrictive, in his eyes, of firearm ownership, that puts them in the hands of people who will do harm and no one else?
Well, I think that's not really the story. With respect to Kennesaw, Georgia, Kennesaw is a town of about 3,000 people, and their crime rate, you can count of serious crimes on one or two hands in a given year. And when they passed their law in the early 1980s requiring the people of Kennesaw to own firearms, there was no penalty if you didn't follow the law. And crime dropped. There was a drop in crime in their first year, but in the next 4 years, crime increased in Kennesaw, Georgia. And the larger lesson there is that it's such a small place to live, nothing wrong with that, that it's pretty hard to extrapolate about the effect of their gun law changes on what it was and is a minuscule crime rate. But if you look at large cities across the country, what you certainly find places like Chicago and Detroit that have had serious crime problems, continue to have problems, but not all large cities with strict laws have high crime. New York City certainly is the exemplar. It's the largest city in the country, and its murder rate and serious crime rate continues to drop, despite the fact that the murder rate has been going up in other cities. And this has been happening quite a bit around the country, where some cities continue to experience drops in serious crime, and other cities have seeing the opposite, especially with violent crime and murder. And frankly, criminologists are kind of scratching their heads about it. I mean, one thing we know is that while guns play an important role in violent crime, guns and gun possession per se is not the sole explanation for crime. There are many factors that contribute to crime. And if you take a place like Detroit, I mean, Detroit is a city that's, you know, bankrupt, that's coming apart at the seams socially. I mean, there's a web of social factors that explain and do explain the rise of crime in a place like Detroit. So if you want to explain crime, guns are in the mix, but they're certainly not the only explanation.
All right, I'm late for a break. Let's take our only break of the hour. We'll come back to your phone calls and questions for our guests. You're hearing Dr. Robert Spitzer on the line, a distinguished service professor of political science at SUNY Cortland. He is going to be here in Rochester on Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Third Presbyterian Church on East Avenue as a guest of the Rochester Coalition for Reasonable Gun Laws. That's a coalition of about half a dozen Rochester area organizations. Neil Jasek, representing that group, is with us in studio. Also here, Dave Jenkins, the founder and primary instructor at Rochester Personal Defense LLC. Chris Nakis is here. He is a gun owner, a hunter, and someone who's talking about his own concerns about gun laws. So we're going to incorporate your phone calls for the rest of the hour after this short break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, an arts hour focused first on 6x6, the small art international sensation that comes to Rochester in June. We'll be telling you about how artists use 6 inches by 6 inches to create artwork that would probably surprise you. Then we're going to talk to students, some of whom working their first jobs creating murals around the city this summer. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Want to get to your phone calls now, and I'm going to start with Steve in Rochester. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Evan. First, I want to contact you know, comment on the confiscation aspect and the claim that it's puffery. Many of us, you know, on you know, that have guns to protect our children, the people we love, believe that it's not puffery, and we can actually point the fact around confiscation that make it very clear that the socialist mantra is to restrict, register, ban, and confiscate, and ultimately lead to what's been done in Australia. And if you look at the SAFE Act, as I call it, the Unsafe Socialist Act, it's really a perfect example of this.
Steve, there's a ton of guns in Australia, right? I mean, Australia took 30% of guns in 1995.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Let me pose my question first.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand.
My point is, in the SAFE Act, if I register my so-called AR, then when I die, my son cannot inherit it. It is confiscated. I have to turn it over or sell it. That's a part of the SAFE Act. Another part of the SAFE Act is that if you have 30-round magazines, you have to destroy them or sell them out of state. Whether you want to call that outright confiscation with the, you know, socialist Gestapo is knocking on your door and taking them by force, or it's stealth confiscation, that's exactly what's going on with the SAFE Act. It is confiscation, whether it's stealth or it's overt, but it is confiscation. And it makes absolutely no sense to ban semi-automatic rifles if you're not going to ban shotguns with spreader chokes and all weaponry and head towards the fate of the Australians. And I can prove that to any rational person by showing a round from an AR, so-called AR, and a shell from a shotgun with number 4 buckshot. With one trigger pull, with an AR, you're going to put out a .223 round, which is a little bit bigger than a .22. With one trigger pull with a shotgun, you can put out 24 projectiles of about the same size, number 4 buckshot. If Adam Lanza knew what he was doing, he never would have used an AR. He would use a simple shotgun, a simple pup shotgun where you can put 7 shells in there, with a spreader choke that spreads the projectiles horizontally, and he could have killed everybody in that room with far fewer trigger pulls. I think he had to pull the trigger like 160 times to kill the 26 people he did. With a simple pump shotgun with a spreader choke and number 4 buckshot and 24 projectiles per shell and a spread of 3 feet, how long do you think it's going to take somebody to kill everybody in a small classroom?
So, Steve.
Let me finish the point, though.
Okay, but I don't want you to hang up, so go ahead.
What the SAFE Act will do is ensure that the next time somebody wants to do something horrible like Sandy Hook, they don't use an AR. They use a simple pump shotgun with a spreader choke where the carnage is going to be exponentially worse.
Okay, so Steve, stay on the line, please. Dr. Spitzer, sure. You want to respond to some of what you heard. Go ahead, Dr. Spitzer.
Yeah, sure. It is true that under the SAFE Act, which was passed in early 2013, that if you owned an assault-style weapon that's described in the bill, that has two or more characteristics that would have been legal to own before 2013, now New York State is saying you either have to modify the weapon, which is not unduly difficult to do, as I think some of your guests will agree, or you have to report it indeed, and you can continue to keep your weapon. If that weapon remains with, let's say, the two characteristics and you pass away in the future, then indeed you cannot pass that down to your children. It is also true that the magazine round limitation in New York State since 2000 has been 10. The SAFE Act included a provision that reduced that number to 7, but the one provision that was struck from the law when it was appealed through the federal court system was that particular provision, because the court said that the shift from a 10-bullet maximum to a 7-bullet maximum was an arbitrary decision, essentially. And so the standard in New York has been 10 bullets since 2000, and that was also the standard in the federal assault weapons ban from 1994, but again, that's not in effect anymore.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
It's stealth confiscation, pure and simple.
Can't agree.
Okay.
Can't agree or disagree, or fundamentally, what am I saying that's incorrect?
Well, sir, there are approximately 300 million guns in America. About two-thirds of them are rifles and shotguns, and about a third of them are handguns. And the idea, I mean, leave aside the law and the politics for a moment, the idea that something akin to confiscation could actually occur such that people would not be able to get guns or keep guns is incompatible with the fact that we have 3 million guns in America and maybe 1.4 million police officers. So it's not even, it's beyond my contemplation how that could occur. Aside from the fact that there's no political
It actually is occurring right now with the SAFE Act, so I don't know.
Okay.
Why is it beyond your comprehension when it's actually occurring?
All right, Steve, let me just jump in and say I'm trying to make sure I understand. So what Dr. Spitzer is saying is so-called assault rifles, as defined by the SAFE Act, make up a very small percentage of the actual guns out there. And that, yes, if you try to pass them, you can't pass them down. When you die, that you're supposed to give up that gun. What Steve is saying is that is de facto confiscation. That if I can't pass it on, that gun is going to be taken away eventually. And what Dr. Spitzer is saying is that if you don't modify it, then yes, that's correct. But that's such a small percentage of the guns that it's impossible to then leap and say the whole mission is gun confiscation in this country.
I'm sure in Australia, they at one point thought it was impossible too.
Steve,
and that's the point.
Steve,
the socialist mantra is restrict, register, ban, and confiscate over time.
Steve, do you think there are no guns in Australia?
What's that?
Do you think there's no guns in Australia? I'm just trying to understand what you think about what is happening in Australia.
They've banned, they've confiscated and banned many, 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 many guns. So
30%.
They disarmed the populace.
30%. And by one recent count, there are now more guns than there were 20 years ago. But they banned at the time 30%. That's a lot. In this country, that would be almost 100 million firearms. Probably never going to happen. But they didn't take all the guns in Australia. I mean, Dr. Spitzer, am I wrong?
Well, yeah. You're correct. In 1996 in Australia, there was a mass shooting at a place called Port Arthur.
Right.
And after that, the government, actually it was a conservative government, by the way, implemented a new measure that was a gun buyback. It was a mandatory buyback of assault-type weapons, and so you would turn in your gun and they would pay you.
To be fair, I think a mandatory buyback is
confiscation. And that was the program that they used to have people turn in a particular type of firearm, and Australia had had about a dozen mass shootings up until 1996, and they've had no mass shootings since that time. Now, I would just add that Australia has some similarities with the United States. They had a certain frontier tradition, sort of like we have had in the 1700s and 1800s, and they had have a fair amount of gun ownership, but not as much as in the U.S. But it's also a smaller nation, and it's interesting to make those comparisons, but it's also a mistake to overgeneralize when you're examining the behavior of nations because there are so many different factors at play.
Okay. Now, Chris, I know you had some concerns. You want to weigh in on that?
See, we're talking about semi-automatic rifles and mass shootings and everything. Well, let's just be real. The crime rate or where criminals are committing crimes are done primarily not with semi-automatic rifles, with AR-15s. They're done with handguns. They're in the inner cities, and the crime rate is happening. And these are mainly unregistered illegal firearms that are being used in these situations. Now, when you start putting more, quote, sensible laws on the books for citizens not to be able to arm themselves in Chicago, in Detroit, in Rochester, in wherever you're going to put these laws are. Basically, it's illegal guns that are being used by criminals to commit these acts. And the vast majority of killings are done this. Before Dr. Fajer was on, we just heard somebody had stolen an AK-47 and shot up the kids over on Genesee Street. And what was that? An illegal firearm. In Sandy Hook, illegal firearm. San Bernardino, illegal. It was obtained illegally. Chicago, they're not NRA members going out picking up firearms at a gun store and going out and committing crimes in Chicago. It's not happening. It does happen where illegal firearm is used to commit a crime, But the vast majority is not that.
Okay,
and we're talking about magazines that are 30, you know, with a capacity of 30 rounds, and we're talking about these idiotic little laws. And the vast majority of these things that are happening are from criminals obtaining illegal firearms and committing crimes.
Dr. Spitzer?
Well, I just want to trace back a little bit because I believe it's Chris made a very important point, which is that the vast majority of gun crimes are committed with handguns. And there is a lot of focus, especially in the press, on assault-type weapons. And as a matter of criminology, that really is not where most harm occurs, although in the subcategory of mass shootings, those kinds of weapons do have a special appeal. But even though there are twice as many long guns in America as handguns, and long guns are usually easier to get than handguns, 80% of all gun crimes are committed with handguns. So that is a, you know, a very important point to make, and it's too easy to lose sight of that. Now, in terms of the role of average citizens, of civilians and gun carrying, there has been increasing research on what, if any, effect that actually has on crime. And frankly, there's no particular reason to believe that, I don't know how else to put it, but amateurs with guns, amateur civilians who are hopeful that they can somehow help with respect to crime, that it has any beneficial effect on crime rates or the suppression of crime. There's not only no evidence to support that, there is some evidence to support the idea that it may have the reverse effect, although the biggest effect probably is a very small one.
All right. Part of the point, Dave, you want to weigh in, and then I want to get back to our phone calls. So if you're on the phone, we're going to try to get through as many as we can in the rest of the hour. Dave wanted to jump in with a point. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I pulled up some data from a study done just a couple years ago. This study came up with, this is Bureau of Labor Statistics and the FBI Uniform Crime Report. These guys track everything that happens with crime. And the data they came up with, 794,300 total police officers in the United States at that time. 11% error rate, meaning that there's an 11% miss rate, like a mistaken shooting or a miss, like they didn't hit their target. 14.3 average deaths in a shooting rampage or stopped by police. So where there was a shooting rampage, the average was 14.3 people were dead by the time the police stopped it. 606 criminals killed each year. Okay, remember, this is just a few years ago. When we deal with the armed citizen, now I will qualify that with, I look at an armed citizen and the professional gun owner as someone who has obtained at least a minimal level of training in gun safety and how to use that gun. I also look at other people who take it a couple steps further and decide, okay, if I'm going to carry this handgun for self-defense out in public, I need a little bit more training or better training than just how to keep it safe in my house.
Sure.
So, which is the responsible thing to do. Okay. So some of these people, out of nearly, we'll just say over a million, okay, they have a claim of nearly 80 million estimated gun-owning citizens. Okay. 2% error rate, and the average death during a shooting rampage by the time it stopped, 2.3. Considerably better than when law enforcement shows up. And believe me, I am not knocking law enforcement. But it's the civilian is there.
It's hard to assimilate that variety of statistics. But it is certainly the case that gun training for civilians varies widely. There are 9 states that require no training whatsoever. There are some states like North Dakota, for example, where to get your permit, your carry permit, all you need to do is pay $10 and take a 10-question quiz and answer 6 of the 10 questions correctly, and there's no other training requirement. So you have enormously wide range of requirements. Here in New York State, as you probably know, it's a 10-hour class, and which is pretty good. It's not the toughest that's available. But generally speaking, civilians carrying guns are amateurs. They have less training. They don't carry guns as part of their job because they're civilians. And police, of course, are encountering their job is to deal with criminals or potential criminals. So the idea that somehow, and they do indeed, in fact, police have a higher miss rate than the quotes that you were drawing up there in terms of when they shoot at a target in a live fire situation on the job. But to somehow make a comparison, I don't believe there are any sort of reliable statistics on the hit ratio of civilians in a verifiable criminal situation, partly because it's such a small number that is a verifiable number that somehow compares favorably to police, who, after all, have that as their job.
Well, let's just try to ask. I want to ask what people would agree with. What would you support? What are the actual sensible? Is there a single measure that everyone can agree on? Keith has been waiting to jump in with a suggestion on insurance. Go ahead, Keith.
I got three common sense approach.
You got to make it quick. Go ahead, Keith.
All right, three. One, I'd like to see tax on ammunition and reloading, just to go towards education and to somehow cover the cost that handgun use or handgun ownership causes. Also, I'd like to see a nationwide uniform laws, so you can't circumvent one state's laws by shopping at another state. And the third and most important thing, just like if somebody steals my car, causes injury and damage, my insurance will pay for it. All these illegal handguns that turn up were legal at one time, whether they got stolen from a store or from your house. If you have a gun in your house, I think you should have to have some sort of insurance to cover any costs that would be incurred if your gun ever got stolen, which would encourage people to keep the gun secure.
All right. Keith, thanks for the phone calls. Chris Nakis, would you support insurance requirements for gun ownership?
No.
Why is that?
A gun, well, what is a gun meant for? A gun is meant for defense. A gun, let's be honest, is meant to kill something, to kill somebody. So if you have a gun and it gets stolen, it is not yours. It's not your responsibility if somebody steals your gun and commits a crime with that gun. So now you have to have insurance for that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Dave, insurance.
I would absolutely not support it.
Okay. So there's one idea. Dr. Spitzer, no agreement there. Do you think insurance is viable? Is that a sensible idea?
I think the insurance idea is a good idea. I mean, you can store a gun safely and properly, or you could store it unsafely and improperly. You could use it properly. You could use it improperly. So insurance laws are built to deal with just those circumstances.
Okay. He said a tax on ammo. I'm assuming no way for Chris, tax on ammo?
No, obviously we have been taxed enough already, so no.
Dave, yeah, that's probably, and I can't imagine, Dr. Spitzer, that you think that that's going anywhere.
What you mean taxing?
Yes.
A tax? Yeah, I mean, unless it has some very specific purpose that's designed to facilitate things in some way. Yeah, a tax per se, you could do it, but I'm not sure what the benefit would be.
Okay.
Yeah, let me jump in. What this is demonstrating is the very reason I would like Dr. Spitzer and others over time to come up here and to talk about these things. Gun violence is an extremely complex problem. There are different versions of it. There are homicides, there are suicides, there are mass shootings, there are accidents. Each of these has a different purpose and a different cause and a different set of approaches to how you deal with those issues. Gun laws by themselves will never deal with all of the problems and bring it down to zero. But what we have a plethora or what we have a dearth of or what we don't have enough of
there you go.
Is a factual outline with respect to the various causes of gun violence, the types of gun violence, what types of interventions can be effective in dealing with them, what kind of a reduction can we expect from their happening. I mean, we can sit here and argue back and forth of whether taxes are good or insurance is good or whatever, but until we have a factual outlay of what approaches can be effective with dealing with each of these types of gun violence, we're just going to be yelling at each other and providing anecdotal and highly opinionated stuff. Let's get some facts on the table and let's look at it.
Chris, 20 seconds. Go ahead.
20 seconds. Yeah. I'd like to just jump in on armed citizens. Armed citizens have stopped crime. As a matter of fact, you're talking about anecdotal evidence. My good friend of mine, his father, stopped a crime by having a .45 in his pocket. He would have been killed if he didn't have it, right on Mount Hope Avenue. So, an armed citizen can stop crime, and the idea that they're just amateurs, yeah, they are amateurs, but criminals are amateurs too. They're not, you know, they don't go to the gun range and practice how to shoot somebody. They're criminals, and they commit crimes, and armed citizens stop that.
Dr. Spitzer, I know we'll see you here on Thursday night, and we essentially barely scratched the surface, but I hope that we can continue this with those who agree and disagree and come to that discussion on Thursday night. Thank you for taking the time for this program, Dr. Spitzer.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Robert Spitzer is a professor of political science at SUNY Cortland and an author on the subject. He's going to be here on Thursday night, 7 p.m. at the Third Presbyterian Church on East Avenue. Not sure if Chris is going to be there. Maybe they will. Maybe they'll continue this discussion there. And Neil
If I'm not working, I'll go there.
There you go. Neil Jastic, thanks very much for your time as well. Real briefly, Dave, online, where are they going to find you?
Go to RochesterPersonalDefense.com.
Thanks for taking the time, Dave. Short break, more connections next.